You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Energy, whether in the form of oil, gas, coal, nuclear, ethanol, wind, or solar, drives the U.S. economy. But the energy industry and its various lobbyists have also been a driving force in Washington for decades. Overall, they have spent around $58 million on lobbying so far just this year. And that money, for better or worse, has had an impact on everything from the price of gas to climate change to the debate over increased offshore drilling and how much corn is grown in Iowa. Well, joining us now for part two of our three-day series on lobbyists is New York Times reporter Matt Walt and Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, Ken Silverstein. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Matt, there are many different energy interests in this country, from oil to nuclear to solar. Which of them would you say is the most powerful energy lobby in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, that's a tough call. Probably oil, because they get enormous tax breaks. But the ascendant ones right now are renewable energy, which get generous production tax credits, investment tax credits, and other forms of changes. Of course, they may need it the most because it's hard to break into an established industry with a new form of technology.
Ken, did they fight each other for dominance?
Sure. I mean, you know, ethanol is the ethanol industry has been trying for many years with heavily subsidized help from the U.S. taxpayer, been trying to get a bigger share of the market. So, yeah, I mean, you don't have one energy lobby. You have, as you noted, a variety of competing forces.
And do you think, I throw this out to both of you, that any one of these sectors may emerge as a winner after the presidential election is decided?
Well, I think ethanol is in trouble because of the declining price of gasoline and the rising cost of food, which may or may not be because of ethanol, but certainly ethanol gets blamed for it. I think part of it depends on who gets to be president. John McCain is notable among national political figures as opposing ethanol. Very few national political figures will dare do that. I think that...
And Barack Obama has been a supporter. In fact, his state is an ethanol-producing state, and ethanol has been credited with his winning the Iowa caucuses.
That's the sort of ritual genuflection you have to make to that lobby to win in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Obama has been a really, really strong supporter of ethanol. I agree with Matt. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, these are issues that are not these are somewhat beyond the control of the president. I mean, if gas is going up, then there's keener interest in alternative energy, including ethanol, though ethanol has all sorts of environmental problems as well. But Obama has been extremely close to the ethanol industry, and Tom Daschle, the former senator who is on the list of people who might be his chief of staff, has real strong ties to the ethanol lobby. So it'll matter who becomes president in that sense. And, you know, Obama is from a farm state, and he's been very conventional in his backing of ethanol. And McCain, not, you know, being from Arizona, has been an opponent. So to a certain extent, I think this is a little bit of politicking on both their sides.
So if ethanol came out of a cactus, McCain might be a stronger supporter. Of the $58.5 million donated by the energy industry to political candidates, around $34 million came in contributions from individuals. Around $24 million came from PACs. Does the distinction between the two mean anything in terms of benefits for the energy industry, Ken?
I don't think so. I think it's sort of a phony distinction. In terms of the source of the funding, again, there's a lot of politicking around this issue. You know, Obama has talked here about how, just in general, not just in terms of energy, that he doesn't take any money from lobbyists. But, you know, he takes money from law firms who lobby, just not, you know, from people who are registered to lobby themselves. And, of course, he's also taken money from state and local lobbyists, just not federal. So, you know, the source of the money, ultimately, they're big special interest groups find a way to get money into the pockets of the candidates one way or another. So, Obama certainly received a lot of funding, not as much as McCain from oil and gas, but probably more in other areas.
Matt, do you know if contributions from the energy industry as a whole, not just oil and gas, have generally favored Republicans or Democrats?
I think they're like contributions from other industries. They tend to favor either the party in power or the party you think that is going to be in power next.
Uh-huh. So right now the Democrats are doing better than the Republicans. But the largest contributor is ExxonMobil, isn't it, at least of the individual, one of the top donors. And they have given to Republicans 4-1, and they've also favored incumbents.
I don't track that closely, but I think to a certain extent it becomes the tail wagging the dog. There are other issues out there that are crucial to energy but not centered on energy that may make more of a difference than who contributed to what. Mostly, both McCain and Obama, and at this point even President Bush, favor very sharp cuts in emissions of carbon dioxide, and that is going to make a big difference in the energy business. It disadvantages coal. It creates new demand for natural gas. It may pave the way for more nuclear plants. It does not do anything good for ethanol as it's currently made. It may pave the way for some alternative fuels that are not commercial at this point. And that may be more important than tax breaks we give to various industries.
Well, last month, the House and Senate fought over providing tax credits for solar and wind producers. Why is an issue like that, you would have thought it's really safe, why is it so contentious in Washington?
Because the safest things are the most difficult to do. If you think back to, for example, whether we need a national enforceable standard for grid reliability, everybody agreed we did for years and years. In 2003, we had the massive blackout, and then everybody said, oh yeah, we really need it now. And it still took another 3 years. Because everything's connected to everything else, and when you have a piece of legislation you're sure everyone in Congress is going to vote for, you're sure to hitch it up into something that's much more controversial so you can get the controversial thing that you want piggybacked along with the thing everybody wants. And hence, we have trouble doing what everybody wants, which is things like tax breaks for wind and solar.
Well, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, oil and gas interests make up the majority of industry contributions, totaling around $26 million so far this year alone. Ken, what kinds of things do you think that money could buy the oil and gas industry in Washington? And is there any hard evidence of any real influence?
I think it's more complicated than simply the political contributions and the lobbying. Obviously, those are important factors.
You mean there is no quid pro quo?
Well, I mean, let's look at 2005, which was the when the big energy bill that Congress passed that year. And I think Matt was referring to this in some, or not referring to the bill specifically, but just in terms of how difficult it is to get anything done. And then when you finally get a bill, everybody's trying to get a piece of, you know, their own particular piece of pork attached to the bill. But, you know, you had this big energy proposal that ended up, I've seen various figures, but it was at least $14 billion in subsidies that were attached to this energy bill. And, you know, I mean, there was all this talk, as there always is, about how this bill was going to, you know, decrease our dependence on foreign oil, and it was going to move us sharply into alternative fuels, everything else. But, you know, the biggest sort of concrete impact was that it larded oil and gas companies with an additional $14.5 billion in energy subsidies. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say it wasn't just oil and gas. It was the broader energy industry. So, again, I don't think it's simply a question of, you know, because you have competing interests here fighting for different things. It's not simply, this is a big issue. It's not simply lobbyists and special interest groups ask for something and they get it, but certainly they have a lot of influence. And, you know, when you see big pieces of legislation like the energy bill, look who gave the money and look who got out of it, look who got something out of it. And usually there's some correlation there, at least, a fairly strong correlation generally.
I mentioned earlier that ExxonMobil is one of the top donors. It dominates oil and gas production, also electricity and coal mining. And when it was created by a merger in 1999, there were members of Congress, the Clinton administration, and antitrust officials who were wary of the two companies merging. Do you think that lobbying by the two of those companies helped change the minds of important officials?
I would certainly say there was an impact there. I mean, this is bigger than simply energy. I mean, we've had just, you know, virtually no opposition to big mergers in recent years. It's become increasingly rare when the federal government comes in and actually says, no, you know, you're not going to be allowed to go ahead and do that. And certainly the energy industry has become more and more consolidated. There have been a number of big mergers in recent years, and, you know, the companies spend a lot of money lobbying on that. I mean, I was looking just this morning, because I knew I was going to come on to talk about this, just looking at the American Petroleum Institute's lobbying. I believe, of course, I can't dig up the precise figure right here. I had it just a second ago, but I think they spent something like $4 million on lobbying last year, the oil industry trade group. And, you know, they've got just dozens and dozens of lobbyists who work on a variety of issues. I mean, it was a 13-page filing. So, you know, they're lobbying on a huge variety of issues, and certainly antitrust has been a big one. At this point, you know, there aren't a whole lot more mergers that can occur, but certainly Exxon and Mobil would have lobbied hard on that issue.
I think those things are true, but I think also that the role of the oil companies is changing, and that a giant oil company is a smaller player now than a giant oil company used to be. They're still big in refining and distribution, but they don't control the cost of oil.
I'm talking with Ken Silverstein, who's Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, and Matt Wald, a reporter with the New York Times. We're talking about lobbying in the energy industry. And Matt, in this election cycle, we've heard a lot about clean coal. The Washington Post reported earlier this year that the coal industry and its utility allies spent more than $35 million on advertising in primary and caucus states, and that number probably has gone higher since. Why do you think the industry has spent so much money on improving their image this election season?
Well, I would argue that whatever they've spent money on, they didn't get what they need most. And what they need most is a program to test different strategies for carbon capture. The Department of Energy dropped the main strategy earlier this year and came up with a substitute that I don't think is going anywhere. I think also this is a precursor to the climate debate, which is how much carbon control can we afford, how much can the American economy handle as a charge for carbon emissions. And that's going to be much bigger than the 2005 energy bill or any of the energy debates we've had so far.
Well, both Senators Obama and McCain have endorsed the use of clean coal. They both touted that during the debates. Many environmentalists claim there is no such thing. Do you think that their enthusiasm, is it all linked to that ad campaign?
No, I think that coal is a major American industry, and it employs lots of people. The power plants employ lots of people, and cheap electricity employs lots of people, and you got to have guts to mess with that.
Especially for, again, I think Obama, you know, there are very, very big coal interests in Illinois, and, it's been an issue that's difficult for him to confront because of that. I mean, certainly he was heavily lobbied by the Illinois coal producers. And, yeah, I mean, the clean coal, I don't claim to be an expert on this, but there's a lot of debate about whether that's a contradiction in terms.
There's also the coal-to-liquid fuel conversion process that the military wants to experiment with. It is reported to emit large amounts of carbon dioxide. And last month, Politico reported that under a new defense authorization bill, the coal industry stood to sign 10-year contracts with the military to experiment with that. According to the article, the coal industry turned to former Air Force Secretary Michael Wynn for help. So lobbying in Washington isn't just limited to people in Congress and in the administration. Does money pass hands when they're lobbying the Defense Department?
I think you're looking at something else that I think you're focused on money because it's easy with a few mouse clicks to find out who's given what to whom. But there are other aspects to consider here. One of them is, here's a place where environmentalism and money run in opposite directions. There's no doubt that at $140 a barrel, you can make liquid fuels for airplanes, cars, and other things at a price that's lower than oil. At the current price, it's not quite so clear, but it's probably also true. The flip side is that you roughly double the amount of carbon dioxide per unit energy, and you're watching the beginning stages of a national debate over how serious we are about limiting our carbon emissions. All we've done so far is set far, far future goals that are extremely ambitious, while in the short term we're continuing to increase those emissions.
So, But does going to the Department of Defense, especially since the Department of Defense the Air Force, for example, the single largest fuel consumer in America. Most submarines run on nuclear power. Is it important to convince them to use one system rather than another?
Often in energy and other systems, nuclear power is an example, technologies originate with the military and then move into the civilian sector. And one of those technologies could be coal to liquids.
Governor Sarah Palin often mentions the natural gas pipeline between Alaska and the lower 48 as one of her signature accomplishments. Can either of you talk about her relationship with the energy industry? The Associated Press called the bidding process for the pipeline flawed, said it favored TransCanada, a company with ties to her administration. As its name implies, the company is based in Canada, and I was wondering how strict the rules are governing lobbying by companies based in foreign countries.
Well, if you're lobbying for foreign government, you have to lobby. You have to register as a foreign agent. That's not exactly my area of expertise, but I would point out that she's claiming credit for something that hasn't quite happened yet. It's not exactly clear when that pipeline will be built.
And just in terms of the question of foreign lobbying, yeah, you do have to register. There are no restrictions on foreign company or foreign country, for that matter, lobbying the U.S. Congress or U.S. administration. I am not familiar with, you know, what sort of, if there was any particular lobbying by that company on the pipeline project in question, though.
Well, Randy Schoenman, who's an advisor to Senator McCain, lobbied for many years on behalf of the government of Georgia. And two oil and natural gas pipelines run through that tiny republic. Ken, do you think that either of those things influenced Senator McCain's sharp-worded response to the Russian invasion of Georgia?
Well, I mean, you know, Schoenman is a lobbyist for that government, and there's no question he's McCain's closest advisor. You don't want to draw too hard and fast a line. I mean, McCain's got a longstanding position that's very, very critical of Russia. But certainly, I think if I were the government of Georgia, I wouldn't mind at all having my lobbyist or my one-time lobbyist being McCain's chief advisor. There's foreign lobbying, there's a lot of lobbying done by energy-rich firms. In the case of a country like Saudi Arabia, which is so central to world production and is a major American oil supplier, they don't even really need to do a lot of lobbying because they are they've been so long integrated into part of our sort of national energy security policy that the Saudis have long gotten, they come up for criticism now and then. Post 9/11, they certainly got hammered, but nothing really, because of our dependence on foreign oil, nothing, I would be stunned if anything really challenged the U.S.-Saudi relationship. We just get too much oil from them. There are a lot of the sort of, a lot of the countries in West Africa, which has emerged as a big oil producing region, and the Caspian, are sort of newly emerging. They've done a lot of lobbying to make sure that they have good ties to the United States, and a lot of foreign lobbyists I don't think Schoenman is alone. There are a lot of foreign lobbyists who've worked or advised the candidates.
Well, I wonder whether the energy policies of a McCain administration would be all that different from an Obama administration, except for a number of things like calling for more offshore drilling and perhaps more nuclear plants. They seem to be pretty much in agreement on a whole bunch of things, including caps. They both talk a lot about taking us off of our energy dependency on oil. So would it be all that different if one or another, at least in this area?
I think the secret of the energy world, as demonstrated by the first President Bush, is it doesn't really matter what you favor. What counts is what you can get done. We used to have, as President of the United States, a former paid spokesman for the General Electric Company. His name was Ronald Reagan. He was about as pro-nuclear as you can get. And during his term, we shut down a $4.5 billion spanking new reactor that was finished and operating. That tells you that there are things presidents want that don't actually happen. In the next administration, could we build 45 new nuclear plants? I think that's rough no matter who the president is. Could we get our cars to run on something besides gasoline? Well, in 1992, under the first President Bush, we had a bill that said by the year 2000, 10% of our cars would run on something other than gasoline. The presumption was it would be natural gas. And by the time we got to 2000, the fraction that could run on natural gas had declined. There's a limit to what government can do, and you really got to watch how good the government is at implementing things.
I agree. And you also have to look at Congress. And, you know, there are a lot of... The Michigan congressional delegation, for example, was long and continues to be very pro, actively advocates on behalf of the automobile industry.
Despite the fact that Carl Levin is a leading Democrat, for example.
Right. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you can look if top Democrats and top Republicans, if they're in a state where you have a very powerful economic interest group, it's rare that you see them challenge that interest group. So sure, I mean, Michigan congressional delegation across the board has been pretty much pro-automobile. And, this is a huge issue. It's not simply a question of, the president coming in and deciding, oh, we're going to do away with our dependence on gas. This is, the president can shape and affect and impact policy, no question about it. But these are huge issues, and, you look at the policy differences between McCain and Obama, and they're not all that far apart. I mean, there are some differences there, but in terms of energy, they're roughly similar. And in part, that's because you have huge, huge issues shaping what any president can do with energy policy. But I do think, whereas I would not sort of reduce policy to the influence of special interest groups, certainly it's a factor in shaping it as well.
I think you could rephrase that slightly. You could say their aspirational goals are similar. You couldn't really say what they'll get done is similar. I don't know what the next president's going to get done.
True. That's true.
And we'll leave it at that. Ken Silverstein is... the Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. Matt Wald is a reporter for the New York Times. Thank you both so much. We will continue our discussion of lobbyists tomorrow by talking about the financial industry with journalists Matt Cooper of Condé Nast and Leslie Wayne of the New York Times.